Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered. It is our monthly interview series where I have the good fortune to sit down with the best, brightest, most fascinating minds in the games industry. And today, I am extremely pleased to be joined by Craig Duncan, the studio head at Rare, who has the excitement level through the roof right now of shipping the first major new game from Rare in a little while here.
Yeah.
Little game called Sea of Thieves.
Little game called Sea of Thieves. And this is where I always struggle. Do I do like the reserve British guy going like, yeah, it's kind of cool, we like it. Or do I go full like, hey, I'm pumped and this thing's awesome. And that's my Redmond speak when I go to Redmond and build excitement there. But we're close now. We're getting a lot of reaction. We're getting a lot of love. I get like one part of my job's obviously doing this sort of stuff and just speaking to people about Rare and Sea of Thieves and why we love what we do.
Yeah.
And then the other part is just getting like listening to what people like listening to you guys on Lock tell your stories, reading, you know, people write about Sea of Thieves, seeing comments on Twitter where people say they've made friends or they've had these awesome shit. Like, that's the stuff. We're just in that moment, so it's awesome.
Soaking it in. Well, we're going to talk about Rare, we're going to talk about the game, but we're also going to talk about you. I mean, and your journey, because you are the studio head of Rare. That's a big deal. You joined Rare in 2011.
I did.
The Stamper brothers, who had, of course, founded the studio, had left several years before that.
Mm-hmm.
So what were your expectations heading into that job when you got it?
Yeah, so we can start there and then kind of work back. And I hate talking about myself, by the way, so this is like...
You've come on the wrong show.
Yeah. So I've just kind of put that... And I guess for me, like, and I've always been this kind of person that looks forward. Like, I'm always like, whether it's like I look at opportunities or I'm always trying to just assess the landscape and like, what do I want to do next? What does the studio I'm responsible for want to do next? And so even like the looking back thing, it was funny. I was kind of nervous coming onto the show, and I did tons of press, and I never get nervous about it.
Oh, you know I don't bite, Craig.
No,
come on.
But it's more this I can't remember. I only because I came on this show, I started thinking about like, oh, how did I feel when I first took the Rare job on? And because I knew that would be what you'd ask. So I'd been making games for, I don't know, 8-9 years before that. Before that, I'd run a couple of tech companies.
Yeah, we'll talk about those.
And funny story. It was I was helping Sumo Digital out at the time. I was a development director. I ran development for them. That was post Midway Games, which kind of Midway Games went up in this big ball of bankruptcy. I ran
UK.
Yeah, that was a fun learning time.
Yeah, so, Sumo was best known for Sega and Sonic All-Stars,
which was one of my projects.
Yeah,
which was
excellent game.
Yeah, and had a lot of fun there. And I knew those guys, and they were going through a growth phase. So post Midway, they were like, "Hey, Craig, we'd love to have you as part of our leadership team and just sort of help us grow." And for me, that was what I needed. I needed to work with some people on some games and just like get the Midway thing in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
But I always knew Sumo was just going to be this transitional thing, and I talked to people about doing a startup. And then I get an email out of the blue from, and I don't think I've ever told this story, so this might be interesting. I get an email out of the blue from Matt Booty, who now is head of First Party Studios,
yes.
Was CEO at Midway Games, was actually my boss at Midway Games as well.
It's who you know, isn't it?
And he just said, like, hey, you know, in a conversation with Phil and some others, we're talking about UK gaming leadership. Don't know like where you're at now, but if you want, I can intro you to Phil. And
Phil
see if,
Spencer for the kids at home.
Yeah, and
you're on a first name basis.
and see if like if there's something like if it's something that could fit for you and something that could fit for us. So it was like no more than that. Like,
right.
Hey, if you're thinking, like have a think about Microsoft. And it was just that exact time where I was kind of going, okay, like, you know, we chipped Sonic and Sega All-Stars Racing, we'd done a couple of other things. I'd set up the next thing, which was Sonic and Sega All-Stars Racing Transformed, longest game name ever. Great game, the name was a bit long, and so timing wise it was kind of right. They were doing Nike Fit for Microsoft and a couple of other things, Little Big Planet, I think they see what we're doing at the time as well. So you start these conversations, you know, Phil and I exchanged a couple of emails. He said, hey, there's a guy called Will Mazzell who's a GM. He's over in the UK. Why don't you go meet him? So you just go through this kind of courting process.
Sure, yeah.
Of like, hey, come meet some of our senior guys, see if you connect, see if we connect culturally. And rare, what, like, it wasn't rare at this point. I guess that's the long way of saying it. It was just like, hey, do you fancy working for Xbox in some kind of role?
Okay.
So I met with Will. I met with a guy called Scott Henson, who they just kind of implanted in from Redmond to help Rare and assess the studio. And,
yeah.
So he and I met and connected. And I kind of go through this thought process, okay, what do I think, like, where do I think Xbox is at? Where do I think Microsoft's at? What do I think they need? What do I want to do? Because you've got to make sure all those things align.
Sure.
Because for me, what's important is, hey, do I believe in the mission? Can I work with people that inspire me and give me energy and do cool stuff? And like, how can I create a role around that? And that's what I had at Sumo. That's what I had at Midway. That's what I wanted in my next role. And then some point in the conversation, I can't remember where, it was kind of like, hey, like, what do you think about coming in to lead Rare? And that's when I had that moment where it's like this is Rare. Like, this is like, and I grew up playing Rare
yeah.
games. And again, I've been lucky in my career where, you know, I started working at Codemasters. I remember playing Codemasters games as a kid. Midway games, obviously, like we all
Everybody.
Made Midway
yeah.
arcade games and their console games and got to work with other IP like Sega and stuff. So I'd already done I'd worked with brands that I'd grown up with that meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
But Rare was, I think, from a career point of view as well, it was just like, okay, I've done publishing. I've done internal studios in a publisher. I've done independent development, Sumo or independent developer. Mm-hmm. I've never ran a first-party studio. So just for a, like, oh, this is new, which appealed to me.
Sure, just new challenge.
New challenge. And then it was like, okay, so I know I can run a studio and run a team. Can I run a first-party studio? And then it's like, and where are Rare at? So I start doing my research. I actually, I don't think I've told anyone else this either. I actually started a new game attack. Because I went and replayed all of the Rare 360 games and went and replayed Banjo and Perfect Dark remasters we'd done on Xbox Live.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want anyone in the industry because most of the people on my friends list are in the industry and we didn't have, like, be offline back
right.
then.
Yeah.
So I literally start a brand new gamer tag and start playing through all the Rare back catalog.
An alt gamer tag to stay incognito.
Because I didn't want anyone to know that, like, hey, why is Craig all of a sudden playing all these Rare games again? Viva Pinata and everything with it. So I go do that and then I start sort of forming my own picture, okay? And you know, one thing leads to another. I go in, I meet all the leadership team, have a really late night at Rare. They all, again, incognito because I'm still working in the industry. I'm still working for Sumo at the time. Hey, come in, meet some leadership team. It's like 9 o'clock at night in Twycross site's incredible, but walking around at night, it's just this spooky kind of.
It's kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Middle
it?
Of nowhere,
yeah.
Yeah. You go in past all the cameras, and I'm meeting up with the leadership team, and they're telling me what they think the opportunities and problems. And super interesting time for Rare. It just.
That was the Connect period.
Connect had just launched.
Yeah, 2010, and you joined in 2011.
Yeah, so through the latter part of 2010 was when I was having
okay.
all my conversations. So it was like, Connect's going to launch. we've made this game called Connect Sports, which isn't a pack-in, but we think it's going to be pretty successful. Yeah. Like, and then it was kind of blank from that point onwards. And it's like, hey, we want someone to come in and help shape what that looks like. We think this Connect is going to be a big deal. We think Connect Sports is going to be a big deal. And here's the studio, here's the team, here's everything you've got. But the part of me that professionally was challenged, like, hey, I haven't done this before, this is great. And then there's the other part of me inside, which is like, hey, when I will run Rare. Like, I will be the Rare studio head. And it's still, even if I'm out at an industry event now and it's like, hey, I'm Craig, I'm the studio head of Rare, like, still there's this little thing in my inside me that's just like, oh, that's cool. I have that. I literally have the coolest job.
So what was your first day like at Rare then, after all this has gone on and you know, you've got this, like, childhood fantasy bucket list, career bucket list thing checked off?
Yeah, I mean, anyone that knows me, like, I say things as I feel them. I'm a pretty normal guy. I, like, think of myself as a pretty normal guy. So I go in, and my daughter kind of mocks me for this all the time. She's like, Dad, you've only got one look. It's this kind of slightly stern, like, slightly intimidating. So I go into Rare, and I kind of meet people. I knew a few people. Actually, this chap called Travis Ryan has got his own indie studio now, who was my lead designer at Sumo on Sonic All-Stars Racing, who'd actually left to go to Rare.
I guess the UK game development community isn't necessarily the biggest place. You probably see some.
That's it.
Places.
So there was a couple of people. Rare actually didn't really recruit senior people from ex. Like, I think I was the first senior leader Rare had ever brought in externally. So they'd had, you know, a lot of people come in as graduates. People had been promoted up. So you had a lot of long term Rare people in very senior. I think pretty much all the leadership team were all 15, 16-year Rare veterans, 20-year Rare veterans. So, and I'd met all them before. So the first day, I just went into listening mode. We had an all hands, which is what I think all teams use.
Yeah, everybody does that.
Yeah, to bring everyone together. Scott Henson, what I didn't know at this time, had presented to the studio about a week or two before, might get the date quite wrong there. But basically once I'd agreed to come in, but before I joined, in saying, hey, we're going to bring a new studio director in as an experienced guy, but until he comes in, we don't really want to sort of announce it. We'll announce it all when it happens. And he drew this org chart. Here's how this person's going to fit in. He used Batman as the org chart. So the expectation coming into me first day was like, hey, like, Batman's joining the studio. Because he just used, and because we talked about comics and other stuff, like, he just used this Batman moniker.
So, does that mean when someone would question a decision, say, why'd you do that? You could just say, because I'm Batman.
Well, I wish I had of. Like, so there was this weird, like, hey, there's a new boss coming in, but we're not going to talk about who he is. So I'm sitting in this all hands, and it's like, hey, like, Craig, do you want to say a few words? And they covered, like, hey, Connect Sports looks like it's come out the gates well. We've got a couple of months sales. Here's what it's doing. And I mumbled something probably incoherently about, hey, I'm looking forward to working with you all. And, like, for me, it's about execution, and part of my job here is to help you guys do cool stuff. Yeah. I'm in listening mode, I'm in learning mode. Like, so it was all hands, it was meet people. And I think whenever you go into any new job, I think that's your role, really. It's like, go figure out who's who, like, what have I got, who are the people that are coming to me with issues that I can help solve, like, what are the frustrations. I think I said to you when we met earlier, like, I think now, this week, today, like, is my 7th year anniversary. I don't think
that's
I've
awesome.
Thought back to day one until you literally asked that question. And it's that, you know, it's really like, I think when you go in new, I've liked being the new guy walking into a company, because you can just go into it just completely objective.
Yeah.
Like, no agenda, no, like, I don't know anyone, tell me what's going on, let me see if I can help, let me see if I can work out. And I think when you're, even now, I'm 7 years in Rare, there's probably stuff I'm blind to that a fresh perspective coming in and looking at stuff would help me out.
Like, so you have school-aged kids.
Yes.
Do they like bragging about Dad's job? Because, or is it...
Yeah. It's kind of weird, and I use the point, like, I work hard, like, and I work hard, and I've always worked hard. Probably my upbringing, like, my parents always worked, it just, like, but I work hard because I feel I feel responsible and accountable. Like, I feel responsible and accountable for the 180 people
at Rare. Yeah, of course.
For
that's
the
good.
People that play our games. Like, and that's what kind of fuels me. So most of my conversation with my kids is like, hey, Dad works hard, but, you know, when we go on holiday to Disney or, you know, like, we can get a nice car or whatever, it's like, hey, and it's trying to just instill in them, like, hey, like, if you want to get on, you work hard.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that, I think that's more important than the what I do. Like, my son's a massive gamer, my daughter games not quite as much. I think she's, like, she'll be more interested in this sort of stuff. Like, oh, Dad, you were in an interview on YouTube. Yeah. Like, that means you're famous. Well, I'm not really famous. I just run a studio, like, in our industry.
Right.
Like, and Patrick, like, if one of the Rare games hits his radar, he's interested. If not, he's going to carry on playing Fortnite and Minecraft and
so
other stuff.
Are either of them into Sea of Thieves right now? Are they liking the game? Do you play as a family?
We've played as a family. We did a Rare recruitment event, and I actually, because I'm horribly disorganized, didn't mismanage the calendar. My wife was going out with a friend. So I took the kids to, we had a recruitment event, one of the studios, I can't remember which one, had closed down. And we said, hey, we'll open up a bar nearby. We've got some job postings. And so I took the kids, because I was on babysitting duty, hadn't coordinated the calendar. So I took the kids along, and my kids literally spent the whole time there, almost in an E3 type environment, playing the game with people from this studio, and like that was probably like them, say, kind of being mini me's, but they were like, oh, like, why is there a 14-year-old and a 13-year-old here playing Sea of Thieves? And it's like, oh, it's like, that's my dad over there. He's talking to that guy. Like, he runs the studio, but they like, I'll show you how to play the game. And they were almost
awesome.
Doing the E3, like, oh, you know, like, there's a map, and here's how you go get treasure, and just engage it. And I think they love the creativity of it. So
I love that.
Yeah, it's cool.
Now, you didn't start your career in games, if I've got this right. You got into the industry back in 2003 with Codemasters.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about your previous life and how you end up jumping into the games industry.
Yeah, the short version of that story, because obviously, I guess 23 would have made, or 2003 would have made me 26. So, you know, fairly normal school, grew up in a working class town called Corby. I did paper rounds, earned money, bought video games, did all that stuff that kids do. Actually didn't know what I wanted to do, had no idea. Went through school, was kind of okay. I'm a bit like my son, which is he kind of does the work he needs to do to get by. My daughter absolutely pushes herself and works super hard. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. Kind of went on to do A-levels afterwards because I didn't know what I wanted to do. That's kind of the thing after high school in the UK. And did that for a year and was like, I don't really want to do this. I don't want to study anymore. So I took a job in an engineering company that made aerospace kind of engine components out of ceramic. So completely random. Fairly manual. You're using molten ceramic into these massive machines, lifting kind of 40-kilo bins full of multi-ceramic. I was in my late teens, I guess I was 18, 19 at the time. All I was really interested in was going to see bands, going to the gym.
Yeah.
So actually having a job that I could lift big bits of ceramic and metal, I was like way fitter than I am now and was kind of fun. But I think over that kind of couple of years, I got the bug for like just working with people. Like I've always been a people person.
Yeah.
And again, some of this maybe comes to my mum and the upbringing. Like, she'd come home from work and she'd worked in loads of different places and she'd talk about how the management don't know what they're doing and people are idiots and, like, all the answers are actually on the shop floor and just all this stuff you hear a million people say. And I think when I got into the world of work, I liked earning a living. I felt like it was a good thing, you know, hard day's work for a hard day's pay.
Yeah.
And once I started talking to people, I just hit this light bulb moment where it's like, oh, okay, like, so these guys run production and then there's an engineering team and the engineering team set the process for the production team. And whatever wasn't unlocking for me at school unlocked for me the moment I hit the world of work. And I'm like, oh, okay. So, and I start talking to the engineers about how they do setups and they had some problem things that were, again, like low yield thing, things that were breaking. So like I'd go speak to different people, and again back to that objectivity point, I just use the objectivity of going like, okay, if I can go ask some people about what they think it is, and actually help them solve some stuff. And at the end, so I was working there as a summer job. I was due to go back to school, and at the end of it, they said, "Hey, you seem like a bright lad." It's funny now, I'm 41, but you seem like a bright lad. Why don't you like continue on? And like, we can probably, like, if you're interested, maybe. And it wasn't really called an apprenticeship, but like, we can get you working with the engineers.
Yeah.
You can kind of like skill up a little bit on some of the tech side. And I was just enjoying it. Like, I was enjoying the work-life balance. I was enjoying having money. Most of my friends kind of finished school, went on to university.
Right.
So I was just in this sort of interesting, like, okay, let's see. My parents didn't really sort of put pressure on me to do one thing or another. They're just like, hey, as long as you're happy, go do it. So I worked the shop floor. I then moved into an engineering role. I then moved into a process role. I then kind of, once I felt I knew everything about that company, took a process job at another company. It was literally 5 minutes down the road, like went in as a new guy, learned stuff, like, and just enjoyed that process of like people fixing issues, got involved in a thing called Kaizen, which is like continuous improvement driven by Toyota. Like, oh, and it, for whatever reason, that just stimulated kind of me and the kind of person, like, oh, if I can go in and make a company better or make a team better. And then just kind of took every opportunity that got thrown my way. Ended up in managing a larger team, took a job in Birmingham. It's about an hour away from me. I said it's a short version, it sounds very long now. I told you we shouldn't do this. But took a job in Birmingham that I probably couldn't afford to take. I took a big loan out to get a car to drive the 60 miles away it was, but it was a management role and it was in a software company. So I'd always been fairly techy. I'd built my own computers. I'd never, like I've heard some of the other unfilters you've done, like I wasn't a kid programmer or anything. Like, I love games. I used to kind of mod, but just play around. But, you know, working in a software company, and I thought, can I take all my process and people skills, do the leadership stuff? I actually went and did a software engineering MSc course, so part of a degree, just to learn software engineering, system design, programming, like at a very high level. I'd done a bit of art at school. Like, so all of these, you know, art, science, tech, leadership, all of these things were starting to form.
Yeah, you're just soaking up all these different bits of everything.
That's it. In a way that was just very, you know, I was continuing throwing myself into situations where I had to learn and skill up really, really quickly.
So how does Codemasters find you? Or how do you find Codemasters and make the jump to the game side?
Yeah, so I was running engineering projects. I had a friend of mine that worked as a games journalist. And I'm obviously not as bright as I think I am. I hadn't even made the link. Like, I consumed games, I played games, I grew up a gamer. Gaming was still I'm working my ass off, doing all this work for all these different companies. Gaming was my chill.
Yeah.
Like, that was just the thing I did at the weekend with my friends, like, and just, it was just and
it was a hobby.
I hadn't even made the link that people made games at that point. And just around 2003, think about it, so original Xbox, PlayStation 2's kind of, you know, accelerating pretty quick.
Oh, yeah.
And games companies' teams were growing. So you were in this point where teams had gone from 12, 20 people to 30, 40, 50 people. Software projects were becoming multi-million pound software projects. And all of the software engineering projects I'd ran before that, you know, we'd done stuff for rail and aerospace and MOD, and we're all multi-million pound software projects with hundreds of people and tech involved. So I was just chatting to my friend. He just said, hey, everything I read and write about in games is these game projects are getting out of control. They're massive. Like, and all the people that make games, they grew up coding in their bedrooms and they don't know how to run 100-person companies and 50-people companies.
True.
And it just, again, just sparked something with me. Huh. And I looked, and I think it was in Edge, and I seen a advert, and it had the little Codemasters logo,
yeah,
and it was
the
pink one with a little M on it, and it said a development manager. And I was like, okay, so I'm an operations manager for a software company. I know loads about games. I'll take the game Pepsi challenge with anyone. Like, I'll stake that. And so I applied, and I said, hey, I've not made games, but here's my resume, here's what I do. Would love to be considered to be a development manager at Codemasters. And again, I probably had that giddy moment of like, oh, this is Codemasters.
Yeah.
I grew up playing their games. And actually, when my daughter was born the year before, most of my daughter, there's a game called LMA Manager that Codemasters made. It was a football manager game. Most of the time when your kids wake up at 2 a.m. in the morning, you've got to give them a bottle and rock them back to sleep. I had one hand on my PS2 controller playing LMA Manager, because it's a game you could play. It was a management simulator.
It's
a game you could play
slow pace.
Yeah, whilst having a daughter and a bottle in your arm. So I'd played a lot of Codemasters stuff. I knew, didn't realize they were an hour down the road. Had no idea. And they invited me in for an interview, which was interesting. And they were super honest with me, which is like, hey, we absolutely respect all of your professional capability. You've never made a game before. And we tend to have problems if we hire people that haven't made games before. So we're not sure if we should bring you on board, because even though you've got this professional experience, you don't know anything about making games. So, and literally on the fly in that conversation, I was like, okay, like I'll take the game Pepsi challenge. Like I can talk about games. I know what games are. I love games, and I think I can combine the two. And if you look at anything I've done, like when I haven't known things, I've gone in and I've bridged the gap and I've learned, and I basically convinced them to give me a job.
Nice.
And I kind of went away, and 2 days later, I let her come through the door. And it was like, hey, we'd like to offer you a job as a development manager at Codemasters. And I'm like, okay, better start figuring. So starting to Gama Sutra, reading postmortems, like, and just trying to, again, just skill up.
So you must like that Miyamoto quote from fairly recently, where he said something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing, of he likes to hire game designers who don't have a background in video games, because they can bring that sort of objective attitude or perspective to it that's not necessarily ingrained in the way things already are.
I think that's true, and I would never call myself a game designer. Like, and my team,
analogy, right?
Yeah, I think you're always learning. I think you've got to come into anything with an attitude to learn new. I actually know why Codemasters did hire me, because they had some really tricky projects and they had some really tricky relationships that I'd shown through my interview and my track record that I was a good relationships and people person. The first project I took on at Codemasters was actually Bohemia Interactive in Prague, which was responsible for Operation Flashpoint.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so more of a simulation, a more realistic.
Yeah, the kind of
Ghost Recon-ish
prequel to Armor and where that franchise went. So I kind of met with them and got involved with a lot of their external development. And I think I've heard you guys talk about it a ton. Like, publishing and development relationships is all really hard. There's always perceptions about who's helping who. And that was kind of my job at Codemasters. Like, be a development manager, work with external developers, work out how to get games shipped. And again, I kind of walked into that and, okay, let's learn this. Let's bring my objectivity to it.
What was the most surprising thing in your early games baptism, let's call it, that maybe you just weren't expecting, either for good or for bad?
So for good was, hey, people are really passionate about what they do. So if I present a context of when I ran software engineering at Top Mode Systems, which is the engineering company, you go, hey, Brian, you're going to go make a adaptive cruise control system for a car. Here's your, like, because I know you're a big car guy with Tesla.
Yeah.
Here's your spec. Like, here's your telephone directory spec. Like, you guys are going to go build that. And no matter how much of a car guy you are, like, that's hard to get excited about. You can get excited about the technical challenge of it, but it's not like,
right, you're being,
you don't wake up every morning going, hey, like, I wonder what page 100 on that spec says today. Like, you just don't. Whereas you go into games and people genuinely, like, hey, you get to make games. Like, and I remember walking in there and they're all playing, I think they were shipping IGI 2 at the time, and they were all playing it at lunch and giving feedback and like chatting to the QA guys. That again just felt like, you know, they had awesome jobs because they were helping these games get finished and polished. And so that was the good. The bad was probably egos. So I walk in there and I go, hey, like, I'm Craig. And they go, hey, you know nothing about making games. And I go, okay. And then the first designer I work with, and they're going, yeah, yeah, you can make any decisions around the management or the project stuff. But don't, like, don't, hey, here's your boundary. Like, don't go getting in on the creative stuff.
Yeah.
I'm like, this isn't going to work that way. So, and you've just got it, like any relationship, you've just got to feel it through. And they didn't know me. And you know, it took me a little while to kind of just put my stamp and my way of doing things on things.
But. So you found your way to the aforementioned Midway.
Yes.
Their Newcastle studio, which shipped Wheelman.
Yes.
Which was a Vin Diesel joint.
The Vin Diesel-fronted action adventure.
Yeah. Vin is a big gamer and has been involved in game development in the past. He has had a studio called Tygon.
Yep. With Ian Stevens.
So
yep.
I had always heard that Vin Diesel was very enthusiastic gamer and a pretty cool guy from back working at Tygon or with Tygon with Starbreeze on the Chronicles of Riddick. What was your experience with him?
Wheelman and the transition to Codemasters to Midway was kind of interesting, and again, like, Midway approached me. They had a studio. They were shipping Wheelman. It was kind of, I think it was the first open world game on Unreal Engine 3.
So again, always a technical challenge.
Yeah, just into like that. Just into this kind of like, hey, like, no one ever offers you a job or invites you to do something when everything's rosy and awesome and everything's going great. And I think like every single job I'd done up to that point, there's always, even if it's like, hey, we want to grow and we want to bring good people into the company, there's always like, hey, we've got a problem we don't know about that we need to go solve. And for Wheelman, it was like, hey, like, you know, the studio, they just felt needed a bit more leadership. They had some tech issues. Like, there was just like the game was like, it was just, and all games are hard to make, as you've said many times.
Yeah.
Like, they just had a ton of stuff they were trying to deal with, and some of that was just partnerships with Tygon and Vin and what, like, expectations, and some of that was just Midway and what they had to do and the studio and talent and all that stuff. So you kind of join, figure stuff out. We actually, like, we got a ton of support. Like, most of the heavy lifting, the legwork, was done at Midway Newcastle. But there'd be reviews with Vin and Ian, who was this kind of Tygon Studios rep. And they review assets. So I don't know if you remember the box shot that had the exploding car and Vin Diesel on it. You know, like, how he looked, how much of his face was in shadow, how, you know, how he was portrayed, again, was very important to him. On the gameplay feedback stuff, it wasn't so much. Like, we were kind of left to get on with that, which was good. And I still love the car combat mechanics we put into Wheelman. Like, that game was just... So I actually remember that first day much better, because they took me in and they said, hey, like, do you want to play the game, see what we've got? And I'm like, oh yeah, like, great, of course I do. And they sat me in front of it and I played this level and it was awesome. You kind of went under this freeway and it was like car melee combat, so you'd flick the right stick and left stick and then you could spin round and it would do slow-mo almost like Max Payne style, and you could shoot the guy's windscreen that was behind, like, awesome stuff. And I'm like, yeah, okay. And they goes, yeah, and this is one level, and there'll be like another 30 levels, and we've recreated all of Barcelona, but it's just a bit of it. And it was like, yeah, okay, cool. How far are you on all the other stuff? And they were like, no, that's it. We've shown that E3. It was like, oh, okay, great. And that was just like, I remember that vividly, because then it's like, okay, like, how do we go scale this thing?
Yeah, now you know why you're there.
Yeah. And it's great. And awesome team, great time, loved it. Like, actually, Sean Himmerich, who was our EP at the time, he did most of the Vin liaison, so I was due to meet him, and I think his sister was the management in the management company he was in. Sean did most of the liaison with them, so for me, like I said, I met his sister, I met Ian. I didn't actually go to any of the Vin meetings, just because there was already an existing relationship, and I'm not like I like Fast and the Furious. I'm not a big fan. I wasn't chomping at the bit to go and do that because it was already working.
Yeah, and then of course Midway met its maker in time. So we're moving towards Rare now, and I'm curious. Before we talk sort of Rare specifically, and obviously you're not here for your health. We're going to get to Sea of Thieves. We'll talk plenty of that. But what's I think if a gamer that's listening to this or watching this, I know myself too, even just covering the industry, I get this very cool, grandiose picture of what it must be like to run a studio. So what's the one thing about being a studio head that just nobody in the gaming community knows or would surprise them?
Damn you and your hard questions.
That's my job. That's what they pay me for here.
I think I'm not sure there's a one-size-fits-all studio head. I think
first thing that comes to your mind.
context switching is really hard. And it's something I've got, and this sounds boastful, I've got really good at context switching. So I can have a conversation with Phil about gaming and strategy.
Yeah.
And I can be talking to a program on the team about why something's hard to implement that we feel really passionate about, through to the test guys around what bugs we should be triaging, through to our services engineering team about scaling beta, to our audience team about who we're going to invite in, to our press and PR team about review stuff. It's all over the map. And it's all over the map down to individual problems. And my job is to kind of help make everyone do awesome work.
Wearing basically all the hats and quickly rotating them and off at any given time.
100 times a day.
Yeah.
And just being able to just do that and not be, and this is what I was at the start when I was still learning this stuff at Codemasters. When you're having one conversation about strategy and then someone comes in with a very tactical, should we cut this, waive this, double down on it, spend more money, specific tactical thing, and you don't just go, duh, because you've spent the last 3 hours discussing something that's completely different. You've just got to switch your brain. And now what I do, if you walk into my office at Rare, there's literally whiteboards all the way around the wall, and I've got some strat stuff ahead of me on the whiteboard. I've got a calendar to the one to the side of me. I've got, don't forget to reach out to Ryan about doing Podcast Unlocked. Yeah. A load of stuff on the board behind me, and that's just my way of kind of going, hey, here's the range of what the job is.
Yeah. So if you're watching on video, we've got some of Rare's classics on the monitors behind you. I tried to sort of skew it a little more towards the Craig Duncan era when I could, but what are your favorite Rare games from before you got there?
Yeah, so I had a couple of touch points with Rare. So when I, my second job at Codemasters was, I always get these two wrong. No, I think my third job at Codemasters was head of development services. So I had first-party relationships, which was dealing with Microsoft and Sony and submissions, and the core tech team and the QA team, and I worked with all the studio heads. I actually learned more about being a studio head in that process than, I worked with Gavin Rayburn, who's now at Playground Games. He ran the grid team, so when his product needed submission and QA and all that stuff. But what struck me, so that's 2006, I'm going to get my dates wrong, but I go into the QA department one day, and there's literally a wealth of monitors that are the most technicolored, bright, amazing things I've ever seen. And the team either before that would either test whatever games they're testing, or they'd be playing whatever else they're playing at the time. And literally, I walk in, and it was like someone had poured rainbows into my eyes, and I'm like, what's going on? And they went, oh, they're all playing Viva Pinata, and I'm like. And I knew Viva Pinata. I was like, oh, it's a Rare game. It's just come out, and it's on 360. Yeah. And I'm literally QA department of 50 people, and nearly all of them are playing Viva Pinata. And I'm just like, okay, what is this thing? And I stand over one of their shoulders, and I'm watching them play, and they're just it's awesome, and it's got it's got all this deep thing, and it just struck me so vividly as okay, there's this game that just on the surface just seems crazy and delightful. But and you go into any test department event, like, you know, those guys are like core early adopter super gamers. Like, you know, if you want to go get in the games industry and be a, you know, in test or design or any of those professions, like, you kind of you want to be a big gamer, and they're all playing it. So I kind of go take it home, and again, hooks me immediately. Like, so Viva Pinata, like, I have fond memories growing up of Killer Instinct and Battletoads, but I think Viva Pinata at that moment, because literally all these developers were playing it. Like, I don't know how many, I don't know how many Viva Pinata sales there were, but I imagine a lot of them were people in the industry. And for people in the industry to play a game and look sideways at it, and you can talk about, was it a mismatch audience for where the 360 was and its life cycle and all that stuff.
It was just an underappreciated game.
But, it was just a game that made everyone stand up and say, I put hours and hours and hours into Viva Pinata.
Can we retroactively go back and put that on the box? It's like pouring rainbows into your eyes. It says our boss now.
But but if you think about then, games were quite brown.
Yeah, we were in Unreal Engine powered, grit fueled, gray.
They were
gray and brown,
gritty
period.
And brown. Yeah. And Viva Pinata was just like, it just struck me. So I think that, and I mean, the thing is with Rare, and we know this when we did Rare Replay. Like, there's so many moments that touch you at different points in your life. And I know, like, you know, Kinect Sports wasn't everyone's favorite game. The amount of times I've been at shows. And I've had people come up and say, hey, my kids love Kinect Sports. And now those kids are probably at Sea of Thieves age.
Yeah.
And like, so I think it's a generational thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm curious, have you ever spoken to the Stamper brothers at any point? Do you ever get in touch with them either for advice or just to sort of catch up? Or are they kind of doing their own thing and you're doing theirs?
Yeah, they're doing their own thing. I had a chat I think it was Tim at one of the develop conferences. So they, I think they were getting recognized for a lifetime achievement award, which was absolutely, you know, well deserved. And they built Rare, they grew the company. Greg Males, who's our creative director, still, I mean,
long
obviously
time.
He worked with them a ton, and he still keeps in contact with them. And actually, one of the things we did, to answer your question directly, no, I've never popped round for tea to talk to them about running Rare now, because that would be a bit weird, and I'm sure like they have their own stuff they're doing. And but when we did Rare Replay, one of the conversations I actually had with Greg is like, hey, it'd be awesome, not that we need their permission or anything, but it'd be awesome to show them Rare Replay.
Like their blessing, right?
Given that like ultimately all of it was theirs. So, like, Greg and I sort of passed an email back and forward with Tim and Chris, and Greg went around the house. And again, it was, you know, kind of similar to the Vin Diesel. I didn't think I needed to go do it myself. But Greg went around, showed them Rare Replay, came back. Oh, yeah, they loved it. Like, loved all the videos and the treatment and the, you know, gold frames in the UI. And so,
do they have Sea of Thieves beta access? Have they played, you know?
Maybe. I don't know. I actually don't know the answer to that.
I'd be curious.
They
get them on the phone somehow.
They are absolutely within their rights to ask Greg for a key to access, and maybe they have already. I don't know.
I heard that Rare has what may literally, I'm not sure, be a barn on the property somewhere that has absurd amounts of old, like, original artwork and things and like, sort of old things that probably should be in a museum somewhere.
That is technically correct. I think that story does grow the more people that hear about it. And just again, set expectations. It's not some vacuum sealed futuristic thing where you go into an airtight thing and everything's chronologically
right,
cataloged and cared for. We actually have, it's a great big warehouse that has dust sheets over things like Silicon Graphics workstations that we use to do the rendering back on the
Donkey Kong,
back on the Super Nintendo, and cardboard standees for Killer Instinct and Battletoads. And I think there's a Joanna Dark kind of full 3D model, and there's a ton of that stuff. We have some of it in the studio, and if you've seen any pictures of the Rare studio, you'll see standees and stuff. Like, one of the things I was really keen to do when I joined Rare was just get that balance right of recognizing the heritage and making sure that we have a really strong future identity, and we know what we're about and what we're trying to do, but recognizing where we've come from as well.
But you said yourself that you're a tomorrow's over guy. You're all about, yesterday's over. You're all about tomorrow.
I am, but I know people in the team and fans of Rare, like, that is important to
them. Of course.
And I think recognizing, you can use, and nostalgia is the wrong word, but you can use legacy or heritage to fuel future. Like, when we came up with Players Creating Stories together, which was the kind of ethos that birthed Sea of Thieves, right. and you know, there's a lot of goodness into that. Like, we did Rare Replay, we kicked off Sea of Thieves. Before we kicked off Sea of Thieves, we actually took a video camera around. This video exists, I don't think we've ever published it, and asked people what makes a Rare game. And all, like, everything from, you know, games you can lose yourself, friendly games. The one I thought was the most poignant answer was Ben Wilson, he's our software architect on Sea of Thieves. And he says, Rare games are games that reflect the people that make them. And I was like, okay. And I think that's true. Like, if you think back to that Conker team, you think back to that Banjo team. And again, these weren't my teams, but, you know, some of them are still in the studio now. Like, each Rare games had an identity based on those people. That's why, if you look back through Rare's history, there's just this huge eclectic mix of multiple genres, multiple games, different tones, like, and stuff that I just don't think you'd get out of other studios.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am thrilled to invite you to Rachel Uncensored, my podcast where I get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. From personal stories to hot button issues, we cover it all. New episodes drop every Wednesday, so make sure you tune in on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.
Here's a quick question for you. How did you sleep last night? If your battle for a good night's sleep feels relentless, I have the answer. It's a podcast called Sleepwave, with meditations and hypnosis created to help you fall asleep. My relaxation techniques will help you feel calm and ready for sleep, with soft music that will help you fall asleep in minutes. Most listeners never hear the end of an episode. So search Sleepwave on your favorite podcast app and find out why over a million people have fallen asleep to my voice.
Doom from 2016 strikes me as a game that fits that idea of nostalgia sort of inspiring without sort of overly relying on past.
Yeah, and when I went into the studio, there was two old display cabinets that kind of had all this old merch stuff just stuffed in. And, like, that's not how you recognize nostalgia. Like, and now we refurb the canteen, and there's a wall as you walk in now that's got some old IP stuff, it's got some new IP stuff, and it's just in this mix of some awards, of some BAFTAs, as different things, and it's just there that when I'm doing the tour and we've got a new employee coming in, I'm like, hey, this is what you're joining. Like, this is what Rare's done.
Yeah.
Like, this is why the bar's high, this is why we expect a lot of people. This is why, you know, this is why Sea of Thieves has got expectations around.
So, as we work our way towards Sea of Thieves, how was it working on Kinect? I mean, was it frustrating at any point, either with the tech itself or with the public sort of at one point really kind of souring on it?
Yeah, I think through everything I've ever done, I've learned. Like, and like, if I ever stop learning, I'm gonna stop doing stuff. I'll just go walk around hills in the mountain or something like that. But and I think Kinect is like the ultimate kind of version of that. Like, if you think about just designing a game, building a game for a controller, you know what input is, you know, like, if someone presses the button, they can, and you can play around with, does that make them jump, shoot,
yeah,
whatever. But an input's an input. And Kinect throws all that out the window, because it's like, hey, not everyone throws the same way or kicks the same way. Like, every single human being on the planet is going to do it differently. So from that point of view, the challenge was absolutely there. And I think there is something in Rare's DNA, and I think you can see this in Sea of Thieves, that when we're challenged, when it's hard, when we're trying to do something new and difficult that no one's done before, I think Rare has this almost insatiable need to go do it and prove people wrong and do something different. And I think Kinect definitely represented that. The kind of perception of it is always a challenge. Like, you want, like, I mean, we kicked off the interview going, hey, what's awesome is I read people telling stories in Sea of Thieves, and that's what we designed to do. When you're trying to get a team to ship something that you guys care about, and ultimately everyone cares about things they've put work into, like, and then every time it's talked about, it tends to have a negative slant, whether that's from you guys as tastemakers going, hey, this Kinect thing looks like it's, you know, like, it's not going to work or whatever, or just the feedback in the comments. I think that's hard for a team to be working on something that they're putting passion in that they know not, like, it seems like not everyone wants.
Yeah.
And what I'd always encourage, like, I don't need to motivate my team on anything around Sea of Thieves. Like they, I think I told you earlier, like, you know, one of the designers dropped me a note going, oh, it's awesome, we're doing post-launch contact, because I never want to stop working on this game because I'm having so much fun. And I think, you know, in when we were finalizing a lot of the Kinect stuff, it's like, look, I know, like, a lot of the commentary and stuff out there, like, it's bad, but ultimately there are people that love what you guys are doing. But they're not the kind of people that are going to go comment on a Eurogamer or an IGN or, like, that. That's not them, but there are the people that are going to rock up at Gamescom and tell you that, you know, again, their kids had a great time playing and their family all got together and, like, their granddad played a video game with them for the first time. And that's cool. Like, love or hate Kinect, like, that as an emotional statement, it's cool. So I guess I don't think Rare got credit for the cool stuff it did on Kinect. Like, the champion creator stuff we did for Rivals, like, you could stand in front of it and it made a version of you. Like, crazy clever stuff. You get credit sometimes and sometimes you don't. So I think for the challenge point of view, and the other thing is, like, it was Rare's franchise. Like, Kinect Sports was Rare's. Like, it was the biggest, most successful IP Rare has ever launched. Like, that franchise probably hit, and I can't remember the exact number, like, 9 or 10 million units by the end of it.
Yeah.
Like, that's huge. That's a juggernaut. Like, it was one of the biggest franchises in Xbox.
Yeah, you'll take that.
Like, and that comes down to, like, you know, the team did a great job executing that game. And again, people think it was like a bundle. Or, oh, the only reason Kinect Sports sold is because they gave it away. They didn't. It was a full price game.
Yeah.
Like, so it was hard. Like, I hate people saying bad things about what we're working on because I care about my team. And but, you know, you just gotta make games sometimes.
So and we come to Rare Replay.
Yeah.
You have the 30th anniversary circled on the calendar for quite a while, I'm sure. So how long were you guys cooking up Rare Replay?
If I was way more organized, we would absolutely have Rare Replay. We would have had the 30th anniversary on a calendar with enough time. What we actually did is went, oh, shit, it's like our 30th anniversary. What are we going to do? And we had a few, and again, sort of interesting moment in time. Kind of knew we were going to do a new IP at that point. So Sea of Thieves, it wasn't Sea of Thieves then, wasn't Pirates.
Okay.
That was like, we were exploring this player-shared narrative, players creating stories, like, thing. And Connect Force Rivals the ship. We knew we weren't doing any post-launch support for that. And we went, okay, we need to go figure out the new IP. 30th anniversary is coming up. Very much, what are we going to do to celebrate that? And do we do a documentary? Do we do, like, first suggestion, typical game developer, hey, we should just have a party. We should go invite everyone. Okay, that's nice and it's fun and all that stuff. Should we do a documentary? Do we go, talk about, like, favorite game? Do we do a favorite games moment? Do we do something with you guys and other people in the press, like get them to celebrate Rare in some weird birthday party? What was your favorite Rare game kind of way? And we rocked around all these ideas. And then I was actually at a QBR in Redmond, a quarterly business review that they do from time to time, where different groups come in and show what they're working on. And very, very early on, showed a version of Perfect Dark running in a backward compatibility mode, before it was called backward compatibility.
Right.
And didn't think about it, like, remember the email 6 months before that going, hey, Craig, can we use Perfect Dark to try this back compatibility stuff we're playing around with? Like, Phil's asked us to go do some, of course, like, go whatever. And they showed it working. And didn't really think about it and seeded in. And then we were brainstorming this idea about, like, oh, like, is there a world where we can do... like, give people access to these games. And I was like, oh, I've seen this back compatibility demo. I wonder if we could just, like, sort of get everything back together. And then it's like, well, if you could do that, you could technically go and emulate all the old games. And just stupid game developers, me included, in a room just going, like, oh, we could do this. And, like, you know, didn't some guy get, like, a Spectrum emulator running on a phone? Like, so that must be a thing. Like, we could go do that. And it's like, what if we could do, like, a multi-generational compilation? It's like, no one's ever done that. That's like, because you normally, like, most compilations are normally platform,
right, all one thing. Yeah.
So, and back to that kind of Rare thing, like, no one's going to go do that. Okay. Are you saying we can't do it? Or are you saying we shouldn't do it? But then you miss out all the 360 stuff. Well, funny you should mention that, because I've seen this demo, and I think there's a thing coming that could maybe solve that. So if we get the 360 stuff, what do we need to do? So we actually brainstormed it out, and Rare's done 100. I get these numbers wrong because I'm not doing Rare Replay Press anymore, but something like 190 games during its 32-year now history. And when you take out all the licensed stuff, because they did the Sesame Street game and loads of other stuff, it's like 109 or something like that, I think it's a number. And then we kind of went through this, like, okay, how do you pick what are the right ones? Because not everything Rare made is awesome.
Sure,
like, of course. You know. Like, we're not 100% track record.
Put everything in there.
That's it. And we come up with, quite early on in the pitch, like, oh, what if we could do, like, 30 games for 30 years? And then we got the marketing guys on board around, like, $30. Like, that was the 30 for 30. In the first pitch, I remember it. And so we kind of got ourselves excited. And then it was like, okay, but the 30th anniversary is, like, I think it was 8 months away at that point. And we were in whiteboard stage. So it's like, okay, like, what does it look like to put this team together? So we pulled a few people in, the circle got a bit bigger. Here's what we want to do. Like, here's what we're going to do. Phone the back compatibility team out that wasn't even called back compat then. Like, oh, can we partner with you guys on this? We want to do this Rare Heritage collection and you guys are six of the games. So that's why they were the first... kind of, it might have been six, five, well, however many it was, the first games that were done. So we partnered,
Cameo and PDC.
Yeah, partnered with them on that, got all the other stuff working, like, and just ran and ran and ran. And probably not long after that, I got super convicted and chatting to my leadership team about it. Like, when we announce what Rare's doing next, like, I think if we go out and announce Rare Replay, everyone will just go, oh, Rare's, like, hasn't got any imaginations, not doing anything new. And if we go out and announce something new, it'll be like, oh, Rare's just, like, forgetting about its past and doesn't care. So I got, like, super just energized around the, like, hey, wouldn't it be awesome if we could go, here's Rare Replay, and here's everything you love about Rare, and we like the documentary thing we killed, we actually got that back in Rare Replay. Let's invite all the creators back, talk about the games, put it behind unlocks in there. I'd encourage anyone that wants to know anything about the industry, go and watch those videos on Rare Replay. They're awesome. Like, I learned more about Rare watching them than I knew. But we got really, really excited about, like, hey, if we can announce 30 years of Rare and the heritage, and then we can go, and here's the brand new IP from Rare as a 1-2 punch at E3 2015. That's awesome. And I think Emma, who runs our community team, sums it up really well. She said, from the moment we did that, her life and perception of what it meant to run the community team at Rare changed. Because it was just like, I think we did a really good job of just like reuniting all the fans and people that cared about Rare and got everyone excited about this pirate game, which at that point was one level in engine that had no online bits and was a pirate. Remember them running down the beach with a pirate ship at the end?
Oh, yeah.
Like that very, very first reveal, which may have been too early in hindsight, but whatever. But I actually think that, you know, Rare history, Rare future, such a powerful message.
And so it worked for you in hindsight. You feel good about that?
I feel awesome. Like, even thinking about it now gives me goosebumps because it was just such a... I think just such a great moment for Rare, and I was just so proud to just be the person that could go and just tell that story and do that.
So, Rare's been a pretty secretive company in the past, by and large, but with Sea of Thieves, it's been very open, both in terms of, you know, you've let media into the studio, which was not always a thing that happened. And obviously, you know, they were under NDA, but these technical alphas and constant community blog updates. So, why the switch to
you guys are crazy
to sort of opening the doors a little bit?
It's a great and it's the reason I pause is it's a multifaceted question. I think when we said we're going to go build a new like. Just think of the legacy of the statement of, like, building the next game from Rare, the next new IP from Rare. And that's just something that, okay, what is that? What's it going to be? And I think I've told, like, I won't repeat the players creating stories together and why we got inspired by that and Pirates came later and all this stuff. But we kind of said, like, what does it mean to make a new IP in this generation? Like, and you guys have talked about it before. I think, like, new IP's hard. It's... You know, you've got to have a strong vision. My view of making games, this is not speaking for Rare or Microsoft or whatever, but like you either go make something that's better than everyone else. So you say, hey, we're going to go make something like this and we're going to go do it better, bigger, whatever. Or you go make something different and try and carve out your own space for something. I think Rare do things different. Like I think that's in our DNA. I think it's in who we are. And we said, okay, what's the next new IP from Rare? And then... Really, you then start to break down, well, what does it mean to have a new IP? Like, it means come up with something unique, be really clear on what the vision is, talk about it in a way that will get people excited. And we knew, like, we see that not work more times than it works. And part of getting people in early was like, hey, like, can we get people in as we're going through this process? And can we? And we talked about everything from, hey, do we just put cameras everywhere up in the studio? Do we just like everything from just document the whole thing? Like, and the reason we didn't do that is because people start acting weird when you bring a camera into a meeting room. But really weird. But the point being, it was kind of like, hey, can we put community first? And I know a lot of teams say they put community first, but like, can we invite people into the studio? Can the very first people that play Sea of Thieves be Rare fans? And then can we go build a community around that? Can we grow that community? Can we, you know, build the game with them? And we talked about everything from, like, and it's always like, how do you NDA it? How do you make sure nothing, like, all these traditional things that keep us worried about stuff like that is all there. And you've just kind of got to have conviction. And so we felt they were both intrinsically linked. Like, if we're going to build a new IP, let's build it in a new way. Let's build it with a community that... try and understand what we're doing and our vision, and they can help us and they can keep us true if we're not being open and transparent. And then where we are now, fast forward 3 years, like our insider numbers were like 450,000 people.
Wow.
So this silly insider program we started, which is like, hey, sign up to learn more about Sea of Thieves, which, again, we were so naive back then, is now a set of people that we communicate with super regularly. There's active forums, there's loads of discussion. And honestly, now they, and certainly the people that have been with us along the journey, probably know as much about Sea of Thieves as we do.
It sounds like your community manager should be, or managers should be asking for a raise. is what it sounds like.
What they've had is a raising team. So there was two of them when we started, and we now have 10 people in that team.
Wow.
And that's just on community. And then we actually have bolstered our, like, you know, as a studio, we have a business operations team and a CRM team that write all those emails. Like, you're on the insider program. Like, those emails, how often they get sent, what the redemption rate is on them, how do we know how many people are going to come in, how many people actually show up, what frequency do they show up, how many are in each region. Like, all this stuff a game studio wouldn't have worried about 10 years ago. Like, this is just the new world we're in.
So with Sea of Thieves, when did you know that you had something special? You know, I remember you guys released, gosh, it's probably over a year ago at this point, but a video from a long time ago of Kudo and Phil playing like a skeletal frame of the game.
That was our early prototype. Yep.
So, at what point in the development process do you know that you, or do you believe that you have something special with Sea of Thieves?
Yeah, so the pitch around players creating stories together, and can we, before it was Pirates, can we create a game where the soft skills between players and them going on adventures together that will play out differently depending on who they play with and who they meet is something that just got us excited. Like we're not even Pirates at this point. We're just like, okay, that's cool. Like, there are multiplayer games, but not really multiplayer games that work like this. So imagine if you literally could watch someone playing Sea of Thieves and you wouldn't know what was going to happen. And the way they play literally would, and designers and developers throw around, like, imagine it was just different every single time you play. Every single time you play, it's a different adventure. And you can get excited about that as a promise. And then we did the whole theme. So I said I wouldn't tell the story, and I'm going to tell it. But then we did the whole, like, okay, if that's the thing, how do we get a small group of players to cooperate together, give them share go? We had all these different themes, vampires, dinosaurs, you name it, everything. I'm glad we didn't do dinosaurs now. Ark came along. But
it was a vampire
just
theme.
Just imagine everything. Because at this point, you're going broad. You're brainstorming.
Yeah, of course.
So you're going, here's our creative vision, which we were like, we think this is different to anything else anyone that's out there. Like, this is like no one is doing this creative thing. What's the right theme, wrapper? So we definitely had a moment where pirates was the like, everyone knows what a pirate is. Put people on ships, fairly shared goal. Like, we don't need to over-explain it. The sense of a crew is kind of like a loose bonding thing. Like, so it was a lot that makes sense. So that was definitely the aha moment in the it wasn't vampires, thankfully. That was the aha moment in the concept, which is like, okay, that's probably the right wrapper. And we shared that with a couple of the exec team. I don't think we showed Phil at that point. Yeah, there's a whole story about how we showed the game to Phil, which is maybe an hour in itself. Because I showed some of his other senior people, so they knew that there was something cool at Rare, but he couldn't see it until he came over to the studio. So we sort of did this whole treasure hunt thing. But so once we locked on that, really small team, about 20 people, what we tend to do at Rare is when we incubate stuff, and we're incubating stuff all the time, like we try and just fail fast and build stuff and get features in. So we had this really crude Unity prototype we used that just, like, we were just chucking stuff in. And we knew, so we got the ship working, we got some water working, and we kind of said, we can build something that we know will be fun with friends, because generally most things are fun with your friends, whatever you do, even if the mechanics and stuff aren't there. Can we build something that's fun with, like, strangers, and something that's fun if you're not just friends? And then the other thing, like, once we decided it was pirates and we started playing around with boats, is like, can it just be fun to sail in the world? Like, because, again, as you said it, like, you could perceive, like, oh, just sailing in a world, that's boring, because games are designed to just throw stuff at you, and if there's no stuff, surely that's boring. I would contest to that from everything we've seen on Sea of Thieves. Actually, sailing in the world is just awesome. But when we first had us playing in this really like ropey looking, roughly the same scale. I can show you that video now, and there are things that are still prevalent to this day in terms of scale and mechanics and stuff. But we had fun playing it. And then we actually, and Greg's the kind of master of this stuff, we actually did a lot of like paper prototyping and things around it. So imagine you went to an island and there was a riddle. So you'd do the sailing bit in the engine, yep. And then Greg would literally have a load of post-it notes.
Cool.
And he'd go like, oh, here's the riddle, and here's what you'd have. And we'd sort of role-play it a little bit. So we're even testing the game experience out before we've even built stuff. So really like love this sort of creative process. And then once we got people playing it, we knew we had something fun. I think it was actually that Phil Kudo senior team playtest where we filmed them. And we didn't tell them we were filming them, so we put webcams across all the things, invited them into the barn, got them to play, and hadn't played the game before, didn't have any instructions, didn't tell them we were filming them. We pitched them the, hey, it's pirates, it's shared players, they're going on these adventures together. We'd shown them an Unreal diorama that we'd built of like a single island, which is still in the game now. It's like a resource island, little, you know, little bit of sand, palm tree, looks a bit different now, but here's what this is going to look like, some water tech, but only in a really small, like...
A bathtub?
Yeah, just kind of around the island, so yeah. fixed camera, so it wasn't going off for miles and miles like it is now. So imagine you're going to go into this pirate world and it's going to look like this. Okay, right. So now we'll go over to the barn, and we'll go and play it. And they just, they had a blast playing it. And the reason I think that was such a pivotal moment is they weren't us. Like, so we'd had fun playing it. And this isn't because, like, hey, it's Phil and it's Kudo and, like, if they bless it, it's awesome. Like,
but if they don't, he could just cancel it in 2 seconds, couldn't he?
Yeah, and that's not really Phil's MO in terms of what he does. But yeah, of course you want your leadership team built into it. And, like, I felt confident because next new game from Rare, like, online, like, a lot of the things we were pushing on I think were important. Not only to us, but to the business as well.
Yeah.
You know, Xbox Live back end, making friends, social gaming, like all that stuff's like, hey, it's important to me. I know it's important to Phil. Like that's just, you know, it's good stuff. Like it's hard to argue that's good. But when they played it and they had such a great time, and then we actually went back and edited that video together, and they're all laughing and it's just like, okay, like this is. And like, we weren't even talking about watchable games or the rise of Twitch or anything like that there. This was just like, okay, they just had a blast playing it. And we honestly had no idea what was going to happen in that play session.
Was it very uplifting when you showed that video to the team?
Yeah, well, we actually cut it together. So it was like a 45-minute play session with virtually like very few features in the game, which again makes you think you're on something, because if time disappears and people are having fun and there's not many features in, you know, and what's proven throughout Sea of Thieves, the more things we add, the more fun people have. Like, so we had fun really early on, which again, I've been in game development alongside, and that's not true of everything you make. A lot of stuff doesn't really come together till the end. But we cut that 45-minute video into 5 minutes of, like, here was their narrative. Here's, they wanted an adventure. Phil and Kudo fell out. Kudo found his own ship. Kudo brought back. They had the ship battle. Kudo sunk Phil. Kudo won. They found some treasure. They all had adventures and fun all on the way. And that was the first shared story from Sea of Thieves. And when we sat and looked at that, and we were just like, this is cool. And fast forward again, 3 years, kind of the same thing happened when we took the NDA off the beta. A lot of people played the game. And I had you guys on Unlocked, just like, oh, this is what happened in my story, this is what happened in my story. Like, and that was the vision. So just, like, we've seen it 3 or 4 months into the project, and we're still seeing it now. And that's the special bit.
So what happens to Rare if Sea of Thieves succeeds?
When Sea of Thieves succeeds.
When it succeeds. But, you know, whatever your metric is or what... What happens to Rare in a success scenario?
Same thing that happens to Rare now. We still make games. We still do what we do.
That's a good answer. I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, the conversation, like, we don't know what post-launch Sea of Thieves means. Like, right now, as you and I sit here now, we haven't launched. So,
but you have a plan, you have a roadmap.
Of course. And, you know, we will, like, there's more stuff we want to add to Sea of Thieves. We definitely want to be reactive to, like, hey, if we get some balancing wrong or there's some bug, like, every single person I've talked to that launched a service-based game tells me, hey, you think you know what you've got to do. Actually, when you launch, there'll be a load of different stuff. So I'm not naive to the, like, there'll be a load of stuff we won't even think about that we'll probably have to go do and put people.
Yeah, this interview is airing the day of launch.
Right, okay.
It's all happening right now.
Yeah. So when we're psychic and we've predicted the future, and Joe and the team and I, you know, we've said, like, let's make sure we're really reactive and we're kind of on it day one. If there's stuff we've got to address, we'll go to address. And of course, there's post-launch plans we've got, but really, like, it's really about Sea of Thieves will be its own thing, and hopefully it'll be its own very successful thing. And the conversation I'm having with Joe now is really like, okay, what does that post-launch org look like? Because you can almost think of Sea of Thieves kind of like as a mini studio. You know, Joe runs that team, he has his own leadership team. Like, we ultimately want Sea of Thieves, and Joe and the team will be tasked with making Sea of Thieves as big and successful as it can be. And that's great. Like, and the bigger we can make Sea of Thieves, the more opportunity it brings for Rare in the future. Like, and I people always talk about things as, like, succeed or fail, and I think it's way more nuanced than that. Like, there will be people playing, like, there will be people that love Sea of Thieves. There will be people that play Sea of Thieves a ton. There'll be people that Sea of Thieves will be their favorite game, and that's awesome for us. But there's also people that will continue to come in to Sea of Thieves a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. And that's the way we think about it. Like, you know, I say, hey, we've invested 3 years of our lives and hearts and souls into making Sea of Thieves. But if it's people playing it in 5 years or 10 years and it's a very different shaped game, that's awesome for us as well.
All right, well, then instead of asking you the obvious devil's advocate follow-up of what happens to Rare if Sea of Thieves fails, I will ask you instead, what does Rare's output look like in five? What does Rare look like in 5 years? Then,
yeah, I would love to have the answer to that question. it'd make my planning meetings really easy. I want Rare to do more. Like, I always want Rare to do more. That's kind of been my MO since I've come into the studio. It'd be great if we can have Sea of Thieves as a long running successful service franchise. And then, like I say, we're always looking at stuff. So. Yeah, I mean, right now it's all Sea of Thieves. Tomorrow, who knows?
So, are there other teams at Rare working on things that aren't Sea of Thieves?
Sea of Thieves is our complete and utter focus right now.
But I mean, on that topic though, you've made a lot of comments over the years about, you know, because of course you get asked,
and they always
about
get me in trouble.
Rare's IPs.
I think, but you guys got me in trouble.
Well, we may have. It's our job sometimes. You've said that going back to the Rare old Rare IPs would be the worst thing you could do.
That was taken out of context.
Okay.
I should correct that.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But you've also said that, okay, well, revivals would require new gameplay, which is fair. You know, you don't want to just rehash the same thing. So what, you know, and you've also said in this interview that you're a tomorrow is your focus kind of guy and not yesterday. But so what is the future of Rare's beloved IPs then?
Yeah. Two things for me. One, you've always got to let a team and help a team go make something they're passionate about. Like, so I think when that statement was taken out of context, which was in a 20-minute conversation around why you do stuff, why you do IP. Like, I didn't start out on the start of Sea of Thieves and go, hey, Greg, Joe, Ryan, go make a pirate game that will be number one on Twitch and Mixer in 3 years' time, that will have people shooting themselves out of cannons. And like, it doesn't work that way. And I think that would be the same as me going, hey, team, go do Battletoads, or go do, like, just to pick an example.
Yeah.
Like, and that can happen, and that does, and I'm sure talented developers, they go, yep, okay, boss, like, we'll go do the thing you told us to do because, hey, it'll be review time next year and we want to sit in front of you and go, hey, we did what we told, like, that's not the culture of Rare. That's not the way I run the studio. It's not what we believe in. So for me, like, you've got, like, if you've got a team that are passionate about what they're building and why they're building it and what's new. So we have a very, you know, Sea of Thieves, as I've talked about, like, it was, you know, what Greg and Joe and that core team of 15, 20 people were super passionate about. And it was really up to them to kind of show that what it was. Like, I will back something that's new, different, people say can't be done every single day of the week. Like, it's just in my nature. Like, if you said to me now, hey, Greg, you can't go and do this, like, 50% of my brain would go, like, I can, even if it's something that doesn't make sense. Like, I'll go find a way. It's just, it's the way I'm wired. Yeah. And for Rare, like, I want the team to be really passionate about something they want to do. And they've got to, like, believe it and wake up every day wanting to do this thing. And that's what, in my belief, I think gets you great games.
So if Greg Malis comes to you in 2 years from now, Sea of Thieves is sailing on its own. It's on literal cruise control. And he says, you know what, Craig, I've just got this great pitch for how to bring Banjo back, and I've got 10 people here that have helped me, you know, flesh this out. Can we do this? And you're into that kind of thing?
I think it's just got to be, again, like, I think what we've got to avoid here, especially in the Sea of Thieves awesome press stuff we're doing at the moment, is a load of Banjo headlines. But it's got to have a why to it.
Yeah,
is the best way I can say it. Which is, like, the why for Sea of Thieves was, hey, we think we can go do something else with multiplayer and players creating stories and social interaction that's never been done before. Like, and that, like, if I think about what Rare is, and I think about what, you know, there's a lot of talk about just innovation in our industry and, like, and the 150, 180 people I have in my studio, like, it's important to me, and I think, you know, from my conversation with Phil, it's important to Xbox, that they're going to go do something that's meaningful, that's awesome, that's incredible. And it's not about just doing something incremental. Like, my team is super talented. Like, I could go ask them to make any game in any genre, and they would do a good job, and it would be a good game. But that's different to what we're doing with Sea of Thieves. So to answer that question explicitly, like, it would have to have a why.
Yeah.
That was, like, was one of those things where if someone told you it, you went, oh, like, that would be, like, and almost to the point of it feels uncomfortable. Like, could we even do that? Like, could you make a game where people just, like, the way they interact, like, that is the game? Like, and it would need something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to, I'm not trying to get you, you know, I'm not trying to make a gotcha headline out of this, but you realize, I've got the studio head of Rare here. Mm. I would be forced to walk the plank of the community if I don't ask these questions.
But the funny thing with that with that quote, which I think you guys ran, was, like, it was in the context of a very similar conversation on a podcast, where the point I was trying to make is me going and telling people to make a remake is not the way I think you get a great game.
Yeah.
Like, because, and yes, you can do it, but does that mean you should do it?
Last question on this topic, and I promise I will move on.
No, that's good.
But you know, is there, so Sea of Thieves, it's, you are willing it to success, but everybody's loving it so far, and it's out this week as this airs. Is there a scenario where maybe some of the other Rare IPs are handed out to other developers that have a why pitch, you know, that maybe if Rare is busy, is there a scenario? I mean, we kind of saw that with Killer Instinct,
That was just going to be my answer, and even maybe to a lesser degree, the stuff the Project Spark guys did with Conqueror,
I thought was
pretty cool. So, like, who knows? And again, like, probably a little bit more, like, yes, you need a why, but then you also need, is that the right team, right creativity? Like, we get pitches. Like, we get pitches in linear media, we get pitches in video game. Like, Rare had, like, everything we've talked about, Rare has this 32-year back catalogue of heritage and IP, and while I wouldn't say we were, you know, Disney or even, you know, Nintendo or Sega or any of the other kind of long-term IP stalwarts in our business, like, people ask us to use stuff. Did you see the Battletoads in Ready Player One? Did you see this?
Yes. It horrified. We have, you know, from watching Unlocked, Marty Sleva. He's let's just say not the most passionate Battletoads fan.
Absolutely.
On the planet.
We were all
giving him some grief over that.
But what was awesome about that is Ready Player One is an incredible thing. Like, I loved the book. I listened to the audiobook, which I think Will Wheaton sort of narrated. And but like when they said like, hey, Ready Player One, we want to celebrate culture and gaming icons and all that kind of stuff, and like, hey, could we put some rare IP in there? Like, that's just like a hell yeah. Like,
that's cool.
And they're awesome conversations. Like, but if that's the awesome conversation, and I'm not going to talk about details, but you can imagine what the non-awesome conversations are. Like someone going, hey, can I go do X? Like, and it's like, nah. Like, and it's not, you know, if I was an independent studio, maybe there'd be some licenses that I'd want to go and inquire about and stuff. So it's not... It's absolutely not out of the realms of possibility, but not only does the why have to be right, but the team and the people and who have to be right. So
makes sense.
That's like we and there's a lot of like Rare is the guardians of Rare's IP. Like, and I feel super proud of what we did with Rare Replay, and I feel exceptionally proud of what we're doing with Sea of Thieves, and but they're kind of our IP, and yes. I know people want to, like, people don't want to see them come back badly.
Of course not.
So that's, like, number one job. and then, like, who knows what the future holds.
So Sea of Thieves is the first major Xbox first-party release out the door in 2018 in what should be a pretty big year for Xbox, for first-party. There's a
Hopefully.
Lot of big
yeah,
stuff
yeah.
on tap. So which of those other first-party games are you most looking forward to, personally?
Ooh, I wasn't expecting that question. I was just expecting questions on my own stuff.
Keep it in the family, that's what...
Yeah.
You know, because it's important. I mean, it's the state of of first-party on Xbox has been a hot topic.
It has, yeah,
And this is, you know, you guys are... This is what people have been... What Xbox fans have been waiting for is, you know, this is a new IP, a big new IP... And it's Rare on top of it all, but you know, you've got State of Decay 2, you've got Crackdown, you've got some other things, you know, Ori.
Yeah, I was just going to mention Ori.
And so, yeah, what's on Craig Duncan's radar?
And you know, my brain goes through this like filter whenever someone asks a question like this of like going, okay, we've announced, like so just so again, I don't get myself into trouble. I mean, Ori is a wonderful game, like and a beautiful game, and. Like, I drop Shannon a note every now and then to just see some concept art and stuff of it.
Because
it is eye-wateringly beautiful.
Moon Studios.
Like, and again, like, they yeah. Would you call them a boutique studio? I guess you would, really. Like, they're just, they are.
Well, they're small by modern standards.
Yeah, probably, like,
right?
They're
not 180 people.
Yeah, that's it. And I just think Ori was incredible. So I'm kind of super, just personally, how that's going to play out. I love all the ID stuff. I know it's not the first party stuff, but Charla and his team do an incredible, like, Cuphead was, like, I know you're a big fan, but, like, just such a big fan of that. It's almost like a first-party IP, even though it's an ID. Crackdown, obviously, like my old friends at Sumo, I want that to do
That's
well.
That's right. They're,
I still
they've
feel,
sort of assumed the mantle on that.
Yeah, like,
now.
You know, and like I think anything, I don't know, everyone in the industry is like this, and RIP Midway, it's not there anymore, but, you know, I want to see Codemasters and Sumo and teams that, or even people that have worked for me before that now are doing their own things or working in different studios. I think that tends to be the view you take when you work in the industry. It doesn't just tend to be Crackdown. It's like, oh, like my friends are working
makes
on that.
Sense.
So I kind of like, the stuff I played was last time I played it was really cool. So so I'm interested in that. Ori, State of Decay, I liked the first one. Like I've not really played the sequel, so. I'd love to, kind of Matt and I were chatting about, like, I'd love to get time to play more first-party stuff, but...
Just got to sneak it when you're up in those quarterly business reviews, just get some time up
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is when you get, like, unless it's Pirates, Rare, like, and I literally have no idea what's happening in the world outside of my own project right now.
Well, I'm going to let you go, but before I do, Craig, I'm curious... What do you want the Craig Duncan era at Rare? Long may it last, by the way. What do you want that era to be known for when it's all said and done? Whether that's, you know, in 5 years from now, in 20 years from now, whatever it is.
It's such a hard question because it's not. It's not my era, Rare. Like, there's a lot of, like, Rare's where it is because a lot of people are super talented and they work really hard and they make the culture what it is and they bring the ideas that result in something like Sea of Thieves and the execution that results in that. Like, and this is an internal kind of thing, if the only thing people talk about Rare is like, hey, when Craig was in charge, it seemed they did lots of creative things and the team that was there got to go do some stuff that was really unique in the industry. Like, I kind of think that's what my job is. Like, I think that's what my job as a studio head. Like, I'm not an auteur that's going to come up with, like, the next big game idea that I say, hey, this is, you know, Craig Duncan presents whatever. Like, that's like, of course, I have creative contribution in what we do and stuff, but my job is to basically make sure the studio has the right culture, that all of the brilliant people, and there are so many brilliant people in my team, can do the best work they can. And if that's the output of my time running the studio, then I'll kind of, like, I think we're building something at Rare. And I think we, like, 7 years in the job, the naivety that took the job, I was like, yeah, give me 18 months and this place will be like a machine. It'll be awesome. And it takes time and it takes evolution. And Sea of Thieves, like, took a long time to make. Like, we were doing a lot of new stuff no one's ever done before. But for me, it's like, you know, that, like, we're building something really special and I want to see Sea of Thieves succeed and I want it to have a new life. And I want it to have a long life. And that's the stuff that's important. But not for me. Like, it's the team. Like, if I can cultivate the team, I'm good.
All right. Well, Sea of Thieves is launching now, as you see this interview. So let me be the first to congratulate you on launch here in the past as this airs. But Craig Duncan, studio head at Rare, they are, of course, just launching Sea of Thieves as you see this, which, of course, you can pick up in any store as usual, or Game Pass.
We didn't even talk about Game Pass. We'll get to that.
We'll get to that on Unlocked, which will have also already aired. Chronology makes no sense.
Thank you for inviting me, though. It's great chatting to you.
It was great to speak with you and learn more about your career. And it's, you know, it's not every day that I get to sit down with somebody who didn't start in games.
Yeah.
You're not a lifelong. I found that perspective very, very fascinating. So, Craig, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
For more from the best, brightest, most fascinating minds in the games industry, be sure to look for new episodes of IGN Unfiltered each and every month, both on IGN and IGN's YouTube page, and also on any of your favorite podcast services as well.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am extremely excited to invite you to Rachel Uncensored. It's my podcast where I sit down and get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. And sometimes we might be under the influence when we do so. We cover things from personal stories to hot button issues. And it's the only place on the internet you can find an uncensored version of me. It's a side of me that you might not have seen before because it's not the most family or brand friendly. But don't worry, I'm still sort of slightly a decent human being. If you're intrigued, then make sure you check it out. New episodes drop every Wednesday. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.